Welcome to Expanded Mind. I'm Russ Belville. Today we return to Oakland, California, where in April, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, along with the Beckley Foundation, presented the 2017 Psychedelic Science Conference and Workshops. MAPS founder and executive director Rick Doblin, Ph.D., delivered the opening address, including this portion detailing the use of MDMA, commonly called ecstasy, on a Marine veteran of the Iraq War who suffers from post-traumatic stress.
Now, we have since, starting in 2000, worked with PTSD, and we've done studies in the United States, Switzerland, Israel, and Canada. We've treated 107 people, and we've gotten tremendous results in these small phase two pilot studies where you're looking for your methods, you're looking for the doses, you're looking for your outcome measures. And so the results that we got from these studies were pretty astonishing. Now, you do these controlled studies, and we're comparing therapy either with an inactive placebo or low dose MDMA versus therapy with full dose MDMA, active dose MDMA. So it's not what you might traditionally think of as a placebo, because the control condition is the therapy. And we have to show that the therapy itself really benefits from the addition of MDMA. Because if you could do it with the therapy pretty well and the MDMA doesn't make that much of a difference, then why take the risk of adding a drug? But what we showed is 23% of the people in our study who got the therapy alone or low-dose MDMA no longer had PTSD. It's a testament to the power of therapy. It's roughly 40 hours of therapy with a male-female co-therapist team. But when you add two sessions of MDMA, the benefits more than double to 55% of the people no longer had PTSD. And these are chronic treatment-resistant PTSD patients. And then when you add a third session, and this is 2 months after the last MDMA session, it's up to 61%. But the real question is, does this last? Is this like a psychedelic afterglow? Is there long-term change? And so at the 1 year or more follow-up, we're up to over two-thirds no longer have PTSD. So something, it's fantastic. Something fundamentally is changing in people's brains and their emotions through this therapy, and the benefits increase over time. So I'm going to give you now a two-minute video of one of the MDMA therapy sessions to give you a sense of how MDMA actually works. This is Nicholas Blackston, who was in the book Acid Test, and this is from his first MDMA session, and he was dealing with rage. He'd never beat his wife, but he got angry a lot, he threw stuff, and this was one of his presenting symptoms. So he's going to talk a little bit about that while he's under the influence of MDMA with Michael and Annie Mitchell.
I thought I was being a peaceful person, but I didn't realize how much I was punishing that aspect of me. Mm. I think I was just... I think maybe in Iraq I saw what it was capable of. And I think I was too afraid to... Mm. You know, and a part of me just feels like so bad that I did that. Him. I mean, I know it's me, but I just describe what it
was. Who are you?
But I just that's really amazing. I don't know, I just got this amazing sense of just, I guess, wisdom. I really don't know.
Sounds a lot like wisdom to me.
It was really amazing. And even when I try and think of that really rageful aspect of me, like I can't even, I know it's there, but it just doesn't, I really feel like so much more at peace with like everything.
Great.
Like even if I try and think about Iraq and everything, like I somehow feel like really peaceful about fact that that's my journey. And that,
yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Part of me I mean, I know this is part of the, part of the drug, but when I try and think, you know, am I going to be able to hold on to this, this understanding, this somewhat of wisdom, this knowledge that I have now? I mean, just asking myself that question, I feel like it's so profound that I don't think I could really get it.
Wow. Yeah. I think you can see in a way how the how he's processing that's not that different from normal consciousness. And so I think it does help to make it something that does last, that you can integrate it. The lessons that we learned in phase two, we learned a bunch of lessons. We learned that we can work with PTSD from any cause, childhood sexual abuse, complex PTSD, war-related PTSD. We can enroll anybody that has got chronic severe PTSD. We also learned, to our surprise, and this was my dissertation was based on figuring out how to do the double-blind problem, and it turned out I was wrong. But I thought low-dose MDMA would be the key because it would increase the blinding. And we saw that it did. But low-dose MDMA had an anti-therapeutic effect. It activated people. It didn't reduce the fear. So it's not actually a good control condition. And so we're going to go to inactive placebo. We demonstrated safety in clinical conditions, and we showed a medium to large effect size. And this helped us figure out how to design phase three. So we brought all this data, 16 years of data, starting in the struggle in 2000, to the FDA meeting November 29th, 2016, an end of phase two meeting. We had the New York Times primed. So the next day there was an article reporting the good news. FDA agrees to new trials for ecstasy as a relief for PTSD patients. Of course, we wish they would have said MDMA instead of ecstasy. And then the New York Times sort of condenses the daily news into the daily briefing, which you get on your phones or email and stuff. And this was their daily briefing for the day. Trump transition, Standing Rock, MDMA. No, the first two make you need the third. we just had on Monday and Tuesday here our investigators meeting for phase three. We're bringing people from our 14 different sites, Israel, Canada, and the United States, and we used the opportunity of this conference to start preparing them for the initiation of phase three. This is the design. It's three MDMA sessions, 1 month apart. With 12 non-drug psychotherapy sessions with a male-female co-therapist team. Each of these non-drug therapy sessions are about 90 minutes, three for preparation and then three for integration after each MDMA session. So one group gets 80 milligrams the first time, supplemented by half that 40 after 2 hours, and then they can choose whether to go up to 125 or stay the same. But they don't know exactly that. It's just they say, you know, I want it stronger, I want it the same. And then they're compared with the therapy. And the FDA has approved this design so far. We've had a protocol that we submitted. We got comments on March 8th. They've agreed to some of these key elements. We have still some more discussions to go with May 11th, our next meeting. And we anticipate by around July that we should have an approved phase three protocol and ready to go. Now, we've done a lot of work on the costs. The key driver for the cost is the number of patients that you need in the study. And so if we get the same effect size, a medium to large effect size, as we've got in our phase two studies, we might be able to do this with just 200 patients. And the FDA has agreed that we're going to be able to start with 200 patients in two 100-person studies. And we're estimating that that's going to cost around $20 million. This is our America First plan, meaning focusing just on the MDMA, on the FDA, I mean. And now, if the results aren't quite as good as we thought, the FDA has permitted us to do an interim analysis, and then we would get information, add X number of people to your study, and then you get statistically significant results. So if the results are not quite as good as we anticipate, then we will be able to do it, we think, with 300 subjects. And if it's that small to medium effect size, that'll cost around $25 million. If we do get medium to large effect sizes, for $25 million, there's the possibility we could get it approved both by FDA and European Medicines Agency. But we haven't started negotiating with the European Medicines Agency until after we've come to agreement with the FDA this summer. And if we have this small to medium effect size for 450 subjects, we think we could do it for $35 million. So somewhere between $20 and $35 million, we should be able to get MDMA approved in the U.S. and in Europe. And now we're starting to think even broader than that, our global, this is hypothetical, we haven't checked it all out, but for around 50,700,000 subjects, we think we can get it approved in pretty much every country of the world. now, we already have $10 million, thanks to Ashauna Haley and David Bronner and thousands of other donors who brought us to this point. So it's not inconceivable that we will be able to raise the rest of the money. I really think we will. And the way that FDA will permit this to be a medicine is not like a normal medicine where anybody can prescribe it. They have these risk evaluation and mitigation strategies called REMS, and we're proposing that it's only be able to be prescribed by people that we've trained in the therapy, that they know how to do the psychological component, because it's not the drug, it's the drug-assisted psychotherapy, and it will only be administered in certified clinics. It's never going to be a take-home drug as therapy. It's only going to be used under supervision, and there'll be certain safety screenings initially for who can be in the study. So this is how it'll start, and then it will expand. And the way structurally that we're going to do this is that we've realized that one day, once we start selling MDMA by prescription, that could be a possibility of selling it for a bit more than what it costs us. And then with those profits, we can use and invest in more research. But that's something that you can't keep inside a nonprofit. There has to be a for-profit taxable entity. So MAPS has created the MAPS Public Benefit Corporation. And what happens here is that people make donations to MAPS. MAPS invests in the benefit corporation, and then the benefit corporation will sell MDMA. And the key thing about the benefit corporation is that it's not about maximizing profits. It's about maximizing social benefit. And the only investor in the for-profit benefit corporation is the nonprofit MAPS. So that's our structure. So we're going to be focusing just on just on donations. There's no private gain here. It's all about trying to really improve the health of our society and help us all survive. This is just the FDA gives data exclusivity for drugs that are off patent and for which there are no use patents, which means nobody can use our data for 5 years. And if we do studies in pediatric populations, extra 6 months, which they're requiring us to do. And so I'm just showing this slide to say that in the first 10 years, under conservative assumptions, we're anticipating $53 million worth of profits that can be reinvested in research. So our story to donors is you help us get a jump start on getting MDMA as a medicine, and then a lot of this will be able to be self-funded. Here's the psychedelic clinics of the future one day. This is a beautiful one. One day you'll go to Google Maps and you'll say, where is a psychedelic clinic? And you'll get this. This is also a jobs program. There's over 61 hospice centers in the United States, and every town that has a hospice center, I think, will have a psychedelic treatment center. Thousands and thousands of them. President Trump is talking a lot about jobs in coal. Jobs in coal have been diminishing, but in 2021, when we get MDMA approved and psilocybin is approved by USONA and HEFTER and ketamine clinics, there'll be at least 500 full-time jobs. And over time, there's going to be more psychedelic jobs than coal jobs. So this is the real jobs of the future plan. This is where we should be focusing, alternative energy instead of coal. one of these jobs I hope will be mine, my psychedelic therapy license, started my real career. whether this really comes to pass is due to those of us that are here. We've got the world's leading psychedelic researchers and the community that supported that. And so how we proceed from this moment. So please use this conference as a way to refine what we're all doing. Ask your best questions. Be really responsive to the fears and anxieties of the larger culture and see how we can address them. And if you see any questions that you want to ask of any of the speakers, or formally or not, let's just use this opportunity as a way to refine what we're doing. So really bring your best, most critical, but open-minded, open-hearted selves to bear on the conference over the next couple of days. And then if we do that, this will become more than a dream. Thank you.